Welcome to Orchestrated, a Musio podcast where we discuss the past, present, and future of music creation to explore exactly what it means to be a musician in the modern era. I'm Chris Hazel, and this week Mike Patty and I are talking to the incredibly talented Jean-Yves Bontemps, affectionately known as JB. Now, you might know JB from his brilliant work on films such as The Land, United Skates, and most recently, the box office hit Transformers: Rise of the Beasts. And while he's got the chops and the resume of a typical big-time composer, you might actually be surprised to find out that he didn't start out pursuing a career in music. In fact, it wasn't until he was in his mid-30s, with a family and a successful career in Silicon Valley, that he even discovered his interest in film music. And it was at that point that he decided to take a leap of faith into an entirely new world, starting from square one and building from there. Now, this completely goes against the stereotype of music being a young person's pursuit. And that stereotype isn't entirely wrong. Hollywood is ripe with ageism, and getting into the game later in life definitely sets you up for a little bit of an uphill battle. But JB was determined to build something out of his love for music, and so through years of work and dedication, he did just that. So in this conversation, we talk about what it was like for him to start at the bottom with a more, mature perspective, how his background, his passion, his family, and his faith made it all possible, and how his unique perspective on why we even play music in the first place has shaped his experience in the world of film music. If you like this conversation, be sure to rate and review the episode. It helps the platform know to recommend it, and also we just like hearing what you think about what we're doing here. If you're a music creator and you're looking for inspiring new sounds, be sure to head over to musio.com, sign up to get 30 days completely free, and explore our catalog of over 1,800 industry-leading virtual instruments. We promise you won't be disappointed. A slight disclaimer before we dive into the conversation, you might notice that the audio quality isn't the best. JB was working with a pair of AirPods, and also, like a dummy, I forgot to select my microphone in the virtual studio that we were recording in. So the audio that you're hearing from me is actually my computer's microphone. Again, not the best, and definitely something I'm going to triple check in the future. But if you can get past the less than ideal audio, I think you'll find quite a bit of value in this chat. So without further delay, we hope you enjoy our conversation with Jean-Yves Bontemps.
Hey, I am so excited to be with you guys here today. It's been quite some time.
How do you guys know each other? How'd you guys meet?
Do you want to tell the sort of tale, Mike, or
you had composer tech? You were doing a lot of IT work because that's your background, and I want to hear more about your background, which I know a little of. But you started by making PCs for a lot of composers.
And, I did. But we met before that.
When was that?
Yeah, we met when I was at USC, and that was 2011-12. And you showed up to our class because you were sort of like the sampling gods, the bastion of success that all of us little students were looking up to.
Oh, yeah. And Patrick Kirst. Was Patrick Kirst there?
Yeah. Patrick Kirst brought you in.
Teacher.
And, renowned professor there. And that's where we met you. And then you guys actually both came to our recording session, our capstone session at Warner Brothers. As a matter of fact, you were both there. And of course, made all of us super nervous because, we had these legends like among us. That's when we first met was then. And then we bantered a little bit, both being from Long Island and Hofstra and Hempstead and all that stuff. And then after that, that's when sort of composer tech started after, about a year of being out of school and listless and not getting a job. And then having to hang my own shingle and do some stuff. And that's when we reconnected again.
That's crazy. Yeah. Gosh, I remember. Yeah. We were, now you're doing big, you're a big dude now. You're a big deal. You're out there doing these huge movies now. And I'm just making samples over here on the side. And it's so, I don't know, man. It's just so cool that the day that I found out that you got the Transformers movie, I was so happy. I don't know. I saw it on Instagram or somewhere, and I was just like, it couldn't have happened to a better dude. So congrats. I mean, you deserve it. You've been working on this a long time. But you started off like most of us, have a story where we started, maybe we saw Star Wars when we were growing up, or we saw something, and we're like, I don't know what this film music thing is, but I want to do that. But you kind of had a different career path. You grew up in Long, like you, well, you were born in Brooklyn, right?
Yes, correct. Born in Brooklyn.
But then you grew up in Long Island, Uniondale?
Actually, it was Hempstead. I was around the corner, two blocks away from Hofstra. As a kid, we used to ride our bikes around the Hofstra campus and wait for campus security to sort of chase us off campus because, of course, you college students didn't want us hanging around there. But I grew up there and, you know, music was always a part of my life. My mom wanted to hear instruments in the house. So she was very selfish and made us all take lessons, which, again, was a huge sacrifice because there was no sort of public school system that allowed me to take music lessons as part of, you know, your general education. So my mom, you know, made sure we all had lessons. And for years, I, you know, studied piano and guitar and some drums. But it was never, ever, ever going to be a career for me. Because all of my amazing teachers, they all lived at home with their moms. Because it was extremely difficult to make a living, it still is, as a musician. And, you know, they would gig at restaurants over the weekends or at nights and then teach students during the day. But yet still, with all of that work and their, in my eyes, amazing skills, they couldn't really sustain a lifestyle on their own. So I was like, that is not me. I am not going to be the dude living with my mom. So music is going to be fun. I'm just going to sort of keep it as a hobby. And I am going to move forward and be a lawyer.
How did you land on lawyer? Like, you know, of all of the things, like why a lawyer?
Well, I was really civic minded and I was focused on trying to, especially as a young person, you know, fight the injustices that I saw, whether they were racial injustices or socioeconomic injustices. And I felt that that was the best way for me to make a difference, was to go into potentially international law or go into, you know, some sort of civil law that allowed me to, you know, help people in need that suffered some sort of injustice. So that's why I was focused on that. And music was just going to be a hobby. And really, that idea propelled me not only through high school, where I went to a private school in Long Island, and that's where I did a lot more music education there because they actually had a music program. So I sang in the choir and I played in the jazz band and played in the rock band and all these things. We even did an album for our senior project and we actually recorded an album. I was working at Sam Ash Music in Long Island. Remember that one there, Mike?
Yeah.
So, you know, I was surrounded by music all growing up, but it was never supposed to be a career. Eventually, I went to college. And after putzing around for a couple of years, different majors, I finally landed on music because I felt that it didn't really matter what I majored in. As long as I did really well, I could get into any law school I wanted to. Well, so I majored in music. And, you know, it was more of a general music education. I had no sort of direction or reason why I was doing it. I just enjoyed it. Then I took my LSAT and I realized I wasn't going to law school. That was a big shift at that point. And I said, well, let me try and get into the music industry. So I focused my senior thesis on doing sort of music marketing and music industry because, you know, where I went to school, they had no sort of business program or anything like that, anything that you could actually like get a job with. So I had to create my own sort of independent study in music business. I interned at Sony Music and I would go down there 2 to 3 times a week from New Haven, take the train, go down to New York City, 550 Madison Avenue. And I worked at Epic Black. And I sort of learned the ropes on marketing and street marketing and, you know, so a little bit of A&R and all that stuff. So I was like, okay, I'm going to be a music executive. Get out of college. I end up getting a job, right, as someone's assistant. Mm-hmm. But apparently the person who hired me left before I started. So I got someone assigned to someone new and she hated me. She said I couldn't take messages correctly. I couldn't get her coffee right. There was nothing that I could do to appease this person. So eventually she got rid of me. So I answered an ad in the paper and it was computer programmer wanted, no experience necessary. And I was like, I like computers. I have no experience. It's speaking to me. I go take the interview and the guy's starting his own consulting company. I spend 4 days in training with him. And then I go out to the client as an expert. And of course, I was no expert. But needless to say, I would take my work home every night because of that. Back in the day, I could take the work home on a 3.5-inch floppy. I know I'm dating myself right now. And I go back and do the work, you know, with him. And at the end of the 3 to 4 months, I was basically his number one consultant. And I had really taken to this idea of computer programming. I learned SQL databases and Visual Basic, da 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 da. And I was training all of the consultants, and I was basically the number one consultant at this big client doing a strategic sourcing initiative. So, you know, about a year later, I'm like feeling myself. I'm like, okay, I'm doing well in life. I ask him for a raise. He says no. And then I took my new skills and parlayed to another job, a company called N2K, which was, I don't know if you remember N2K, they had several sites called Music Boulevard, Rocktropolis, Jazz Central Station, Classical Insights. And they were a music online retailer before Amazon even sold music. So Amazon had just come out to do books. Music Boulevard was selling CDs online.
Wow. What year was this?
This was basically 96, 97, 97, 98.
Okay.
Eventually, we were bought by a company called CD Now. And then eventually CD Now was bought by Amazon. So we all got sort of acquired at that. But that had launched an entire career of doing software development. And I did software development for 15 years in Silicon Alley, where I built websites and applications. Because this is, you know, the dawn of e-commerce. So they were just looking for warm bodies to, like, get in there and start building websites. And I picked up Java on top of the language that I learned. I learned basically how to run software teams. And by the time I looked back, after putting together some pretty massive websites and pretty massive e-commerce sites, 15 years later was in Silicon Valley at a major startup that basically was bought by HP.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, I've done great. I have a wonderful life. My family is happy. We have a great house in Monterey, California, you know, driving fancy cars. I have tons of runway. I was being groomed to be the Black Bill Gates, you know, so like everything was perfect, except I wasn't happy.
Right.
I didn't feel fulfilled. And when I thought about software, I was like, you know what? This is not the thing that I want to dedicate my life to. Because I saw people who were really into software and they would spend all day long thinking about software, weekends reading books on software, all that stuff. And that wasn't me. You know, it was a job. And I had this desire to be sort of like great at something. So one night, you know, I'm just sort of like lying around and these words form in my mind. And, you know, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, so I you know, I'm religious. And these words form in my mind. It says, if you trust me with the vision of your life. And I mean, this was God speaking to me. Mm. And I'm like, God, my life's pretty good. You know, I have a runway, meaning I've got like a career path. I wonderful house on top of the hill, looking down on all the white people. This is great, right? I have arrived. So this is like, you know, a great life. Why, Lord, is there more? He's like, no, there is more. And you have to trust me and give this up. And I was like, oh. So, of course, it starts everything in the mind, right? So I eventually started giving up this roadmap that I was on, this path that I was on. I started giving it up. And the same piano that my mom had bought me when I was 6 years old, I had toted that all over the country with me. And I hadn't really touched it, you know, since college. And I just started playing it again. And I was like, oh, I can actually mediocrely play the piano again. Then I started playing in church. Oh, I'm actually enjoying this. Then I discovered this thing called GarageBand on my laptop. I was like, oh, let me play around with this. And I actually remembered to like write some music. I know a couple chords here and there, blah, 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 little melody. Oh, wow. I did something. I sent it to a friend of mine and she said, that sounds like film music. I was like, wait a minute. There's music in film. There's music in video games. And I was an avid video game player, you know, obviously consumed tons of movies. And I never realized this was actually a career or a possibility. When it dawned on me, I was like, wow, I think I want to do that. I think this is something that I could dedicate my life to. And that then started the transition of, well, if this is what I want to do, how is this going to happen? And this was around 2000, I would say maybe 2009. And that started the journey to get where I am. And it really was about giving up this vision of what I thought my life was supposed to be back then and with a clean slate and going on this journey, just trusting that God had a plan.
That's a pretty big leap of faith, man. Like, how old were you at the time that you made this decision?
That's a great question. I was about 34 years old, I believe, 34, 35. I was married to my childhood sweetheart, who I met when I was 11 years old. And we had been married, I guess, for about 10 years at that point, or 8 years, maybe 8 to 10 years. And we had two kids. You know, they were basically 4 and 8 or thereabouts in that sort of age range. So you are absolutely right. It was a huge leap of faith. Now, here's the thing. There was these things sort of came in little bits. It wasn't as if this thing formed my mind. I'm just going to quit my job, leave everything, go to LA and do this thing. Right. That right, wasn't right. The leap at that point in time. It was very sort of sneaky and sly. Just little things. Right. Again, playing the piano, playing in church, playing with GarageBand. Oh, I'm now going to take some classes online at Berklee School of Music online just to see if I really like this. And I started doing that. So it was really these tiny kind of steps that kept leading me toward this thing. And then every step I took, I found that actually I'm really enjoying this more and more and more. And it was taking up all of my free time. Now, I still had a full-time job during this period of my life. And I was still working, you know, in Silicon Valley, still doing my thing. But every night and weekend, I was grinding, trying to figure out this whole music thing. Just because I loved it so much and right. I had a passion for it. Now, I didn't think I had any talent for it because, again, it was just going to be like, you're going to see where this goes. and, you know, eventually my journey took me to this school called Pyramind in San Francisco, where I became an intern. And they were sort of a music school, music community and production house. And I just started interning there. And I was talking with one of the guys who taught there. He goes by SF Logic Ninja. And he was sort of like the Logic, you know, slash producer in the studio. And he was working on an early video game. I think it was a Spider-Man video game, one of the earlier ones. And I was like, hey, man, I, you know, took some orchestration classes at Berklee, blah, blah, blah. I said, like, oh, well, why don't you start orchestrating for me then? So I just started doing that, you know, in my free time. Then I was, you know, interning at events, and I met one event that I was basically, you know, cleaning up, doing the intern stuff, you know, setting up chairs, taking out chairs, taking the garbage out or whatever. And mind you, you know, I was doing all this while I was making a 6-figure income in Silicon Valley that, you know, I didn't tell anybody about, but I had to start over. So I'm talking with one guy and I'm talking about my love of video games and how I'm thinking about trying to make this transition into, you know, scoring. And the guy was like, oh, why don't you come down and talk to me, you know, in a couple of weeks? I was like, well, who are you? He was like, oh, I'm Clint Bajakian. He was the head of music for Sony Games. And he took me under his wing and he said, look, if you really want to make this transition, no one's going to hire you as a Silicon Valley executive. You have to erase the slate and go to USC because we've hired most of our composers out of that USC program. And they had just finished that game Infamous with Jim Dooley, which I had played and I'd loved the music for and all that stuff. And we talked a lot about that. I said, like, so you got to go do that. I was like, well, how am I going to get into the number one film scoring in the world? You know, I graduated college 15 years ago. And even then I wasn't really like a composition major. Yeah, I did my Berklee stuff, but whatever, you know, that's not going to get me into this school. But one of the things that I learned in business is that you can never be a name on a piece of paper. People have to know who you are. And in the software world, I never really applied for a job. People just knew who I was and they offered me things. Hey, I'm going to do this thing. Would you come with me? And we create a position for you. So I said, you know what? This is going to be the same thing. They're going to have to know who I am so that this way they could see me as a person and hopefully fall in love with me as a person and overlook sort of the mediocre music that I'm putting in my application.
That's actually a huge point. Okay, actually, that's a huge point because so much of how this works now is people think they, you know, they create a social media profile or a website and think that that's going to get you work. But at the end of the day, it seems like it's just the old-fashioned who you know and relationships and being recommended.
I want to tweak that just a little bit in that it's not about who you know, but who knows you.
Right.
Because when even though you're not in the rooms, if people know who you are, they're going to talk about you.
Yeah.
And then people are going to get a chance to sort of like know who you are, right? Just because of the fact that you had a presence, or people know, people sort of like who you are. And no one recommends anybody that's going to make them look bad, right? So you really have to make sure that you've delivered, you've done something that people, that is going to make someone look great by recommending you.
How do you get your foot in the door so that people know you and that they talk about you? Like, where do you start with that? You know, when you were figuring this out and you were making this transition in your life, how did you get your name in people's heads as a person to talk about?
I'll use the USC as an example. I just started to visit. I went down to the USC campus and I visited with the then director, Brian King, and we sat down and just had a meeting. I told him about my passion and what I wanted to do. He thought I was crazy. And one of the things that he said to me was, look, you seem like a really nice guy, but I've seen people in your position before where you're all excited about doing it and you have no idea the kind of heartache or hardship you're going to go through with this career change. I was like, well, you know, I really want to do this. So he said, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you the assignment that we just gave our students from our workshop. Teddy Shapiro had just come in and done sort of like the two-part workshop with the students where he gives them the cue and then they write it and they come back and they review it with Teddy. It was a scene from The Devil Wears Prada, that iconic sequence where, you know, Meryl Streep's character is coming into the building and everybody's going crazy because, you know, she has arrived and they're not ready. So, you know, at this point, I look at the scene like, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? And I sit down with my newly sort of found Berklee, you know, online music skills and scored the scene. And then I send it back to him. But then I follow up and say, hey, I'm going to send this to you, but I'd love to come back down for a meeting to review it with you. And he said, great. Mm. So when I went back down, he said, you know what? I didn't expect to see you again. He said, I've done this before with other people and I never hear from them again. Huh. But you actually came back and you also set up a meeting, right, to talk about it, right? I like what I'm seeing. The second step I did was, it's like, you know what? I need to find a professor here that is going to take me on as a private student. Because, yeah, I had a couple things from Berklee, but I really needed to build out my portfolio for my application. So I found the late Jack Smalley, who was teaching composition at the time, and I coerced him to take me on as a private student. And I would fly down from Northern California to LA twice a month and take lessons with him. And after about 5 months, you know, of doing that, I had some stuff that didn't suck. Of course, the entire time I'm letting, you know, Brian King know that I'm doing this. I'm attending sessions and visiting as they're going to Warner Brothers and doing their string recording sessions. I'm basically showing up. And this was another lesson that I learned, which goes back to your original question. It's all about impressions and advertising. You have to not only have almost every interaction with someone be quality, right? But there has to be a certain number of quantity. People have to be able to see you multiple times before they actually remember you or you make an impression on folks. I think it's 5, 6, maybe even 10 times people have to see you. Now, I did have a secret weapon at the time. I was Black. Well, I still am Black, right? And back in 2000, you know, 11, 12, there weren't that many African-American people, you know, in these circles. So I was like the Black guy in the room. So people would sort of recognize me because there weren't a lot of me there. It was easy for me to make an impression because of the way I looked, right?
Yeah.
And I was just sort of like the guy that filtered around in the rooms. So it was the two things, quality, right? Interactions, but also multiple interactions.
At the start of a new career, you're building these relationships, you're building this portfolio, you're building this reputation. You're burning the candle at both ends, right? You were still holding your six-figure job in Silicon Valley while also pursuing this mission that it seems like you are on to transition into music. And that's all, you know, it's fairly normal. When I first started out too, like I was working a day job and then going home at night and working on projects. But I was 22 with no kids, no family. At this point in your life, in your mid-30s, you've got a wife, you've got kids. Like, what was that like trying to balance, you know, working a job, pursuing this career in music, flying down to LA twice a month? You know, what was that experience like for you, balancing all of that?
There's a joke in the Jamaican community, and I'm half Jamaican, that, you know, you don't really work unless you have tree job, man, you know, that Jamaicans work really hard. And I felt that I was in my element doing all of these things. And I was always conditioned, especially from software, to put in like long hours, especially when I was in the Silicon Alley area. You know, we'd get to work at like 9 o'clock in the morning. We would leave at 9, 10 o'clock at night. And that was just the culture. So I was used to these very sort of long days. So what I did, obviously, is I just truncated what I was doing for, you know, the company I was working for at the time. I kept sort of normal hours for that. I would actually take the train up and down. So it was about an hour and a half train ride. And I would actually do my homework then, or I would study, you know, on the train. So I stopped driving so that this way I could actually more time. And then at night, you know, I would actually work, have dinner with my family, put the kids to bed, and then go back and do more work. So in no way, shape, or form during this entire time would my kids call me like an absentee dad or not being around, because I always made sure that they felt my presence. I was there. I was in events for them, actively part of their life. At the same time, you know, I realized that there's a lot of hours in the day, and that I could really focus and use up a lot of that dead time for this pursuit. And I was happy to do it. I was looking forward to doing it. You know, I was looking forward to doing my Berkeley homework or my private study stuff with Jack Smalley. So it was like a joy for me. All right, kids, get to bed so I can go do my music homework, right? And that's how I knew this is something that I really had to do.
Yeah.
That this was what I was meant to do, because I enjoyed it so much.
Well, even as you were telling, you know, your story of before you even got to the decision to make your way into music, it seems like the circuitous route that you took, like every turn that you took, music was always sort of present. Like there was it was always part of your life and something that brought joy. So it's no wonder to me that you would sort of end up at the conclusion that you did. But I'll be honest with you, man, what you're talking about, I have a 2-year-old now, first child, only child, and I work a job, and what you're saying sounds exhausting.
Well, that's what I want to ask, is like, there must have been points where it was really challenging just balancing all of this. Cause I mean, we all have these experiences where you feel like you take on too much. And then you end up, like, for me, it was being a composer,